The other day, beloved listener, you might recall that I had Jim Spiegelman and Ann Curthaus sitting with me in the studio reminiscing on the 50th anniversary of Australia's Freedom Ride. Well, now we're going to talk to a couple of people who were profoundly involved in the American original that inspired it. Joining me are two of the many hundreds of American Freedom Riders who joined in that non-violent civil disobedience that was undertaken in the 60s to fight the profound injustice of segregation in America's South. Robert and Helen Singleton both came from Philadelphia, were studying in California when the call came in 1961 to keep the Freedom Rides going. Now, on the 50th anniversary, Helen, who's sitting opposite me, was honoured with other Freedom Riders at a feast hosted by Barack Obama, who gave her a hug. And she smiles at the memory and told her that he owed everything he had to her and her fellow protesters. So I welcome both of you to our little wireless program. Now, you're here to help celebrate our 50th. How did you come to know about it?
A classmate of mine at UCLA by the name of Bill Ford was from Australia, and even though he, as a Fulbright scholar, was not allowed to participate, he did come to our arraignment when we were at a court of record in Jackson, Mississippi, and he wanted to sit on the black side because they were segregated. They gave him a hard time, but when he spoke up and they recognized that he was not American because of his Australian accent, they let him sit on the black side. Then he came back.
You're kidding.
I've got 1,000 tidbits of that sort. Yeah, Bill Ford and I became fast friends while he was a student at UCLA. We took a lot of classes together in economics.
Helen, tell me about your first experiences of Jim Crow. You're a young girl, and you go down to your grandparents' farm in Virginia.
Yes, my mother, I'm one of eight children. I'm number three. And growing up, we would always go to visit my grandmother who lived in Virginia. We lived in Philadelphia, as you earlier mentioned. And what I discerned on each trip was that we would always be... The grown-ups would always be quite happy leaving Philadelphia and New York and New Jersey, where some of my mother's siblings lived. But as soon as we pulled out of Washington, D.C. and headed into Virginia, I could feel the tension in the car because here was my father driving the car with his wife, who just as often as not was pregnant with the next child, and all of the rest of us sitting in the back seat, and there was their voices would get quiet and begin to whisper about what might happen or where they couldn't go. And even prior to that, the night before we would leave, my mother was up most of the night cooking the food.
Because you wouldn't be allowed into restaurants. Okay.
Yes, exactly. Right. And that's what bothered me, because we had to make, back in those days, they didn't have the interstate highway system that they have now. And so it was just mostly roads, and it took about 14 hours to get all the way through Virginia to Lawrenceville, where my grandmother lived, which was just short of the North Carolina border. And during the 2 or 3 weeks that we stayed down there, whenever we wanted to go into town, we had to wait for Tuesday, which was the only day that they would serve black people in Lawrenceville. And we were not allowed to go to the swimming pools or the amusement parks or the theaters. And everywhere you went, there was a place around the back that was for colored only and place out in front that was for whites only. And you begin to notice that the way you feel when you come upon that situation, it's like they're trying to, you begin to feel the suppression, and it doesn't feel good. And it bothered me during the time I was growing up. And I learned later that they also segregated the schools down south, and I thought that was an atrocity in itself.
In parenthesis, Robert, you've told us that they segregated the courtrooms. Later we'll be discussing your experiences in prison, but did they segregate the prisons as well?
The prisons were also segregated. We were on maximum security unit, and there was the cell blocks were, there was a male, black, female black, white, male white and female white. And toward the end, interestingly enough, so many freedom riders came into the city, county, and the state penitentiary that they had to integrate the blacks and the whites and males on the maximum security unit.
Okay, well, I've accidentally jumped ahead. Let's go back to this extraordinary event in your life when you're training to be a soldier in Augusta, Georgia, and you're ordered by a white driver to get to the back of a nearly empty bus.
Right.
By a bus driver who, in a sense, you're going to protect.
That's correct. We were warned by our company commander that the post was integrated since 1948. Truman integrated the post, but the city of Augusta was not integrated. And he suggested, he couldn't order us not to go into town, but he suggested we not go into town because we might wind up in stockade if we did. Since we're only going to be there for 8 weeks, he said it was best for the black soldiers not to go into town. But I had relatives there. Unlike Helen, I was never allowed to go on family reunions. My family would go on reunions, but they would tell me I couldn't go. And I always wondered why. I found out when I went and enlisted in the Army.
What was the purpose, Helen, behind the Freedom Rides of 61? To some extent, it was to clog the prison system, wasn't it?
The purpose of the Freedom Rides was initially to test the southern states' compliance with the United States Supreme Court ruling, which decided that segregation in the terminals serving buses that had crossed state lines was unconstitutional. The federal government had jurisdiction over interstate travel, and under the Interstate Commerce Clause in the Constitution. And in a case of Boynton versus Virginia, which had been ruled on in 1960, the Supreme Court had expanded their decision from just no segregation on the buses and trains to also include the terminals that serve those buses and trains.
But no one was actually pushing it officially with that.
The southern states were not complying with the ruling at all.
So you were going to force or confront them with their...
Yes, exactly. The NAACP at that time objected. The NAACP stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And they had won the case. The case had been argued before the court by Thurgood Marshall. But the Congress of Racial Equality, which is shortened into CORE, felt that we as a people needed to assault segregation on more than just the legal front, but also by direct action. And that's what the Freedom Riders were. And our purpose was to get the federal government to enforce the rules of the Supreme Court.
Well, Robert, confronting the system was going to put people in harm's way. How did you, and you were in charge of recruiting, how did you find recruits to face this really terrifying prospect?
What we found was that there were almost the same system in a covert way in Westwood near UCLA. They discriminated against us in housing. They had housing covenants. They had some of the shops would not hire black students. There were not that many there at the time. When I got there, I found it easy to organize them, to go in and test these places the way CORE tested the interstate commerce system, interstate travel system. We simply went in and we began to break this down. And we had, fortunately, a chancellor of the university who was on our side. So we one by one, we began to knock down the type of covert discrimination that existed on the West Coast. And when the Freedom Rides came along, we were picketing Woolworth stores in California in sympathy with those stores in the South where the students were sitting in. And that was in 1960. In 1961, when the Freedom Rides occurred, what happened, we already had a posse of people ready to engage.
In fact, a posse is a good term, isn't it? Now, you and Helen and many others, you're arrested as soon as you arrive in Jackson, and you were plonked into that terrible parchment penitentiary. What was it like, Helen? What was that hellhole? Tell us about it.
It wasn't as bad as they had hoped it would be, because they hoped that they would break our spirit. But the fact that they put us all together, and even though it was death row, we could see the gas chamber down at the end of the hall. The fact that we were all together, we gave each other support and encouragement.
You used to sing together, didn't you, and tell stories of oppression?
Yes. Most of us were students, and therefore we were majoring in something, and we decided to set up a series of quote-unquote lectures, and each student would tell us pretty much what they had been learning in school and explain their fields and what is going on, and in some cases what they intended to do when they got out. So we sort of organized our day around the lectures and the singing and conversations. We could not see each other because our cell blocks faced outward with the bars across the front. But we could sort of talk around the walls, if you will. And we didn't get to meet until, some of us didn't get to meet until about 40 or 50 years later.
This is LNL on RN, and my guests are Robert and Helen Singleton. Robert, had you been conscious of the dimensions of bigotry permeating American society, North and South, from childhood?
I had heard stories about it, but like I said, I had never gone South like Helen had. I had never actually been victimized by the system. We had vestiges of it. We had versions of it in the North, which were more covert, where we knew there were some places that we were not welcome. But as children, we didn't care, really. We had plenty of places where we were welcome, so we sort of avoided even being bothered with it. And, of course, it was not taught in the schools. The schools were set up in such a way as to eliminate that kind of information. And we... it wasn't until I went to the Army that it all began to boil down to I understood almost instantly. And I also had already proposed to Helen to get married.
Did she accept?
She and her father, she advised me to write her father a letter, which I did. And from that point on, we were We had no problem. I was 18 when I proposed to Helen.
We were both raised in the schools of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That is the seat of the Revolution and Independence.
Sure.
And most of our field trips that children take were to places like Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
And so we grew up
steeped
on this,
in patriotism.
Yes. Yeah. We grew up understanding the doctrine of equality. All men are created equal.
How dare you take that down south? Yeah. Now, Robert, I was watching a video online of a strategy meeting that was held before you and Helen got on the bus. Tell us about the advice you were given about how to act once you were put in jail. The very jails you wanted to jam up, incidentally. This was quite a deliberate strategy.
Yes. This was a sociodrama that Cor put all of the wannabes, the people who wanted to go on the freedom rides. They had to pass certain tests. You had to not react violently under any circumstances. And lots of people flunked that test. Probably the film you saw, there was a church full of people, many of whom had signed applications to go on the freedom rides, but a large number of whom dropped out once they saw what was expected of them, once they got into those circumstances.
That is an unflinching response to provocation.
Absolutely. And we found, because we had gone through several of these sociodramas, this role-playing, that we could do it, but we had friends with us. In fact, my employer at the time was with us. One of my employers, a professor at UCLA, decided not to go because he felt he might be a detriment to the ride.
If they curse you, if they hit you, if they kick you, you are to take this. You are not to say anything back to them, but you are to attempt to win them over with acts of goodwill. As Luther King said, it is your task to overwhelm them with your capacity to suffer.
That's right. That's Gandhian technique.
Absolutely, yeah. Helen, did you feel that your lives were threatened? I mean, how violent did it get?
Not as violent as it had been in the earlier months of the Freedom Rides. The whole idea of sending us to Parchman Penitentiary, the governor of Mississippi felt that that would be more demeaning and would break our spirits. And it would tuck us away in the Mississippi Delta, away from the photographers, and it would get us out of the headlines.
You would be denied the oxygen of publicity, to quote Margaret Thatcher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my worst event, if you will, occurred when I was separated from the rest of the group because, as you know, they separate the races, and I was the only black female in the group that I went with. So one night, just the night before they took us to Parchman Penitentiary, we were in the county jail, and I was separated, and it was just me in a jail cell with no cot or to sleep on. It was just a pallet on the floor. And as I looked around, there was a lot of trash on the floor. And then a rat entered the jail cell with me, and it was just the two of us. And we sort of circled each other, and then the rat ran over to a pipe that ended right there in the jail cell, and he went up the pipe. And I got down and scooped up all the trash that was on the floor and stuffed it up the pipe so that he couldn't get back down. And needless to say, like I said, that was the low point. That was the worst.
Well, it's bad enough. But, of course, Robert, buses were firebombed. Often riders were beaten up by Ku Klux Klanners and even, of course, the local police in cahoots.
That was the plan of the Klan. They had the city in which they met the most violence happened to be the city where the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan lived. He had sort of orchestrated that whole business of them being violated at every stop. but he told them not to kill them until they got to Anniston, Alabama. Then he said, burn, you know, he wanted them to kill them in that bus. He wanted to set the word out to, send the word out to everyone that that they meant business. And the only thing that kept them from dying, when this bus was stopped and they broke the glass, they held the door so that no one could get off the bus. And then they broke one of the windows and threw in a firebomb. That firebomb happened to land close enough to the gas tank, so the gas tank exploded. When the gas tank exploded, the place had already been burning. They were suffering from smoke inhalation before the explosion. But that's when everybody jumped back, and the Freedom Riders were allowed to get off the bus. They rushed off the bus. Otherwise, they would have burned in that bus.
Did this extraordinary campaign change America?
Absolutely.
In what way?
It changed in more ways than one. Number one, we recognize the fact that if we could get the media to see what was going on, the worldwide media, to come down and actually film as it was happening. And that is exactly what happened. The people from all over the world came down and took pictures. Those pictures you
and
see.
And we saw those pictures, even
those
here
pictures.
In Australia.
That's yeah. right. And Khrushchev and Kennedy were debating over worldwide issues about the Cold War at the time. And Khrushchev was gaining the upper hand because he was pointing out what was happening to Kennedy's people. He couldn't lecture Khrushchev over how to treat people if he was allowing the black people in the United States to be treated this way.
You're visiting a country with an appalling record on racial matters. For example, we had the White Australia policy for generations. Our treatment of our indigenous population, deplorable. We're still not very good at it. We're treating refugees quite monstrously. But this was a time when things were happening here, and we were about to vote on a referendum that would recognise, effectively, Australia's indigenous population as existing,
yes.
as being entitled to citizenship, as being genuine Australians.
Yes.
And one of the people that campaigned on that was a wonderful woman called Faith Bandler, who sat where you're sitting now. And Faith died the other day, and we're all immensely sad about it. But when I talked to her, when I last talked to Faith, I said, would that referendum pass today? Because for a referendum to succeed, it's got to pass by a majority of voters yes. in a majority of states, and very few are ever passed. And she looked at me and said, no, I don't think it would. And I said, is that because there's more bigotry? And she said, no, but it's better organised. Now, I've heard you, well, I've read you saying things that are not dissimilar, Helen.
Yes. The Ku Klux Klan back in the 60s was out front with their robes and their pointed
You could
hats.
See them coming.
Yes, you could see them. And they felt that that was an intimidation in itself. But now they have taken off those robes. They've put on three-piece suits. And
like David Duke did famously.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. But they still are doing not exactly the same thing, but they are creating a pushback, a retreat from the advances that we made. President Johnson appointed Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court, the first African-American to serve in that capacity. When Thurgood Marshall stepped down, it was an insult to the African-American citizens that George H.W. Bush, president at that time, appointed Clarence Thomas
yes.
to the Supreme Court as if that seat itself, first of all, was a quote-unquote black seat. So he felt he'll put a person with black skin in that seat, but this person is a strict constructionist and very, very far-right thinker. He always...
Well, he votes hardline on every damn issue.
With the majority yeah. of right-wingers on the Supreme Court. So that was... an insidious way of pushing back the momentum that we were making as a group.
And, of course, bigotry these days is aided and abetted by the new communications technologies. They can seamlessly link up across a state, across a nation, across the world.
And the decisions on the part of a very right-wing Supreme Court now to, in fact, undo many of those advances that we did. One by one, they are coming up with decisions which are going to, as your lady Faith Thompson, you say, is her name was?
Faith Bandler.
Faith, yeah. Bandler. That, in fact, is happening in the United States. What she observed is happening here is happening also in the United States. The wealth inequality, the income inequality, is putting money into the hands of people who, on the basis of decisions of the Supreme Court, Citizens United can spend it in any way they want. And little by little, they're pushing back against those advances that we made.
Do you find this heartbreaking? Or
It's to some extent heartbreaking, but on the other hand, it gives Helen and me something to do. We go out and we talk to the children at elementary schools. We go to the churches. We go to the schools, the religious schools, and we tell them, it's in your hands now. We did our part, and now they're rolling it back. You've got to raise children in a society where everybody is either created equal, as the Constitution says, or in fact, you've got to recognize that you're going to raise them in a place that is like the place that we fought against when we were young. And the children always sit; they lean forward when we tell them that. They've got to deal with these children, and these children. And I feel that, in a sense, the demographics are so much in our favor that we're going to see a new day.
It's an honor to meet you both. It really is. Helen and Robert Singleton, Freedom Riders in 1961, and here in Australia to help our own Freedom Riders celebrate their 50th anniversary. As I said, when you came into the studio, you've had a hell of a life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that ends the program for the week. Ends it very well. My thanks to the team, Gail Basario, Chris Short, Stan Corrie, Kate McDonald, and sound engineer Michelle Watts. Keep listening to IRN for the news, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.